This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. This is a show about ideas, people, and behaviors that are considered inappropriate, out of bounds, or beyond the pale. The things you're not supposed to talk about if you're a school teacher, a college professor, a businessman, a politician, a parent, a neighbor, or even a podcast host. These are the things you're not supposed to say or even think if you're a good liberal, a good conservative, or a good citizen. Each week, I'll interview a person who has something bad to say. They might be a journalist or a professor. They might be a porn star or a drug dealer. They might just be an ordinary person with an ordinary job who doesn't care about the rules of polite society. I'm not interested in breaking the rules just to be a troublemaker. I'm interested in people who break the rules of conventional thought and who expand the scope of what is possible to say in our society. I'm interested in people who make me think. Tickets are now on sale for two Renegade University weekend events. First, we have the Renegade University weekend in Los Angeles with me. That's February 1st, 2nd, and 3rd. And the second is the Renegade University weekend in Washington, D.C. with me, and that's March 15th, 16th, and 17th. For more information and to buy your tickets for the Renegade University weekend events, go to thaddeusrussell.com/courses. Over the last 100 or so years, nearly all of the major foreign policy decisions in the United States have been made by a tiny handful of people, all of whom were educated in elite universities, and virtually none of whom were elected. My guest this week helps us understand why. Daniel Bessner is the Anne H.H. and Kenneth B. Pyle Assistant Professor in American Foreign Policy at the Henry M. Jackson School of International Studies at the University of Washington. He's also the author of the new and very important and very surprising book, Democracy in Exile, Hans Speier and the Rise of the Defense Intellectual. This is my interview with Daniel Bessner. So I found a professor in the Northwest I can talk to, and he's sitting in front of me. I'm actually in his house. His name's Daniel Bessner. Do you go by Daniel or Dan?
Daniel's fine.
Daniel's fine? Yeah. Okay.
Daniel's good. It's perfect.
I heard you speak on a couple of other podcasts, and I was very impressed with how smart you were, but more importantly, how right you were about a lot of things. And I was also curious about some things, which we'll try to unpack here. But you published a book this year in April?
Yes, right? In April, yeah.
Which is probably will not be read by too many people because it's an academic press, Cornell Press. It says nothing about the quality of it. I find many of the arguments in it to be spot on and pretty brave and unusual in good ways. And it's a biography of a man no one's heard of, including me. And I'm a historian now of US foreign relations. I'd never heard of this guy. Not only that, I used to live in Santa Monica right near the Rand Corporation. In fact, not only that, my neighbor was a Rand analyst and I'd never heard of Hans Speier.
Hans Speier.
And you wrote this book in which you sort of reveal through telling his life story a lot about American foreign policy, American politics, German history, American history in the 20th century, much of which I have been writing about over the last several years. So you and I have been doing a lot of similar or parallel work without knowing it until now. It also turns out you were at Columbia as an undergrad when I was a professor at Barnard exactly the same time, but you didn't take a course with me.
And even though I took most of my history classes actually at Barnard.
Did you?
Yeah, I found the teaching there to be excellent.
Were you boycotting me?
No, I was not mostly taking American history.
See, Daniel, if you had taken my class, your life would have been very different.
I have no doubt.
And you'd be sitting here and I'd be sitting there maybe.
Perhaps.
So let's do a few things. I want to talk about you and your life and how you identify politically. And I also want to talk about this Speier character, of course. But let's start with talking about maybe him toward the end of his career, kind of the culmination of his career at Rand. For those who are listening who don't know anything about Rand, the Rand Corporation, or very little about it, give kind of like the capsule summary of
of all the things that the Rand Corporation did, let's just say in the 60s and 70s. How about that?
Sure. So Rand was the first really national security think tank in American history. It's probably most famous for developing nuclear strategy over the course of the 50s. Many of the ideas that you might associate with nuclear strategy, mutually assured destruction, activities of civil defense, were really first given theoretical expression at Rand in the 50s. And then in the 60s and 70s, it gets involved heavily in Vietnam. James Q. Wilson, most famous for broken windows policing theory, was a trustee at Rand and was associated with Rand. And of course, Daniel Ellsberg leaked the Pentagon Papers from his office at Rand. So that's probably where, if people are listening, they're familiar with Rand. In that recent movie by Steven Spielberg, The Post, the first scene is actually at the Rand Corporation. You see a big Rand sign, A Beautiful Mind, John Nash. Actually, a lot of that movie also takes place at Rand.
He was a Rand.
Associate in the 50s. And also, if you've seen Dr. Strangelove, at some point, Dr. Strangelove gets a report from the quote-unquote Bland Corporation, which of course was a joke about the Rand Corporation. So it's one of the few think tanks that has a presence in pop culture, even to the degree that it was mentioned on The Simpsons. On the episode in Reverse Vampires, Milhouse says that the Rand Corporation is working with the parents to eliminate the meal of dinner. So it has a presence in pop culture, but it's also been quite influential, particularly in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. In the making of U.S. foreign policy.
Okay, so you have a very nuanced take on Rand and Speier, which is admirable in a lot of ways, but the people I hang out with, and you hang out with too, sort of left-wing and libertarian anti-war types, Rand is synonymous with Satan. So what can you just let people know sort of why they're so hated?
Sure. So
more specifically?
Yeah, Rand was one of these organizations that helped build this bipartisan consensus of the U.S. foreign policy establishment that for the United States to be safe in the world, it needs to take a very active interest in managing world affairs. And this was the consensus position that was really developed over the course of the 1940s and 1950s. And Rand, and particularly its analysts, provided intellectual succor to people who believed in this sort of position. So that's why it's been heavily critiqued on both the left and the libertarian right as basically providing an intellectual basis for American imperialism.
Global hegemony. And then specifically, though, they became infamous with Vietnam, right? That's when people really started to find out about them. And what did they do in Vietnam specifically?
Right. There's a great book about this actually by Mai Elliott about Rand in Southeast Asia. But basically, they were influential in promoting the bombing campaigns and arguing that Vietnam could be won on one hand. But I think what it's also to emphasize is that there were actually people within Rand who were arguing very much against intervention in Vietnam. So they may not have been the ones listening to in Washington. In fact, many Rand analysts in the Kennedy administration went to Washington, literally. So some of the so-called whiz kids were from Rand. People like Henry Rowan and Charlie Hitch were Rand people.
Who were they?
They were in the Department of Defense.
When?
In the Kennedy administration and into the Johnson administration. Mm-hmm. So there were what I try to do historically show is that Rand is not a monolithic institution. So there were people both arguing for more intervention and people arguing against intervention. So it's actually a complex place.
Okay. And this guy, Hans Speier, whose name I keep tripping on, but
no, very good.
The reason I remember his last name is that it's the same name as the starting shortstop for the San Francisco Giants in the 1970s, Chris Speier.
Really?
So that helps me. But anyway, back to Hans Speier. He was, what was his title with Rand?
He was the founding head of the social science division. People might have heard of Nathan Leites or Andrew Marshall, who was until very recently a very influential figure in the Department of Defense for decades, the head of the Office of Net Assessment, Herbert Goldhammer, Paul Ketch Committee. So a bunch of these influential figures and other associated figures like Herman Kahn or Bernard Brody were associated with this division.
Okay. So he's... And the social science division is the one that's doing all the foreign policy stuff, or a lot of the foreign policy.
Yes. It was cross-divisional, but social science division was really the heart of these foreign policy, non-game theoretic, non-rational choice approaches to foreign policy.
So if you're an anti-war person, many of the things that you hate the most that have happened in the last 50 or so years, Speier has something to do with it, right?
To some degree, yeah. Yes. In some broad way, part of this larger process that contributed to American
hegemony.
Now,
Daniel, you and I both want to say it is stupid to hate people, don't we? Don't we want to say that?
Well, I think it depends on the instance. I mean, we should hate Hitler. We should hate slave owners.
Really? I don't think so.
Oh, I totally agree. I think so. This is what's problematic with the historical approach.
Okay.
It's like, where is the limit? When do we say historical empathy isn't enough and these people are truly evil and you can't just explain them from their historical context? And I think historians haven't been explicit or really conscious about what that might mean. But I think there are more lines in the sand.
Yeah.
And I feel comfortable saying that.
Yeah, yeah. And you draw those lines occasionally in your book, but most of the book is dedicated to trying to understand this guy.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. I don't think Speier is someone worthy of hate.
And in trying to understand him, you uncover some fascinating stuff. One thing in particular, and I wasn't fully aware of this, I didn't know how left-wing Rand was, at least its analysts, especially in social science, right?
Very much so. Rand is literally a progressive project.
Including Speier. Is literally a progressive project.
In the capital P progressive sense, in that it's fulfilling this progressive goal that you could use rationality and social science to manage world affairs.
So who founded it?
So it was founded with a coalition of military officers, foundation officials, and intellectuals who basically wanted the United States to avoid what they had seen as the problems of isolationism in the 20s, 30s, and 40s and take an active role in managing world affairs, because the fear was that if you didn't do that, things like Hitler and things like the World War II and the Holocaust happened. Accompanying that political project was also the idea that you could manage world affairs through the application of reason and analysis to things like foreign policy. So before Rand, it was mostly lawyers or members of the WASP elite who would be the ones making foreign policy. And Rand was like, no, we need a meritocracy. And this is why Rand actually has a diversifying effect on the U.S. foreign policy establishment with Jews, even some women as early as the 1950s. Very few people who are Black or of Latinx descent.
Yep.
But it did have a truly diversifying effect.
Relatively progressive in that way
for the time
as well.
Yeah, very much so.
But on economics, they were quite left-wing as well.
Yeah,
right?
Social democratic. Most of the division that I know best at this point is the social science division, and almost all the social sciences, as social scientists at Rand, consider themselves to be social democrats, and earlier in their lives had been members of social democratic parties, or in some cases, even the Communist Party.
Now, can you just explain what that means, social democrat?
Yes, social democrat. So basically that massive wealth redistribution at the time, heavy taxes on higher earners, workers having an incredibly large say in the structure of governance at the workplace. So typical Weimar era left wing of the SPD is a way that's an accurate way to describe the economic political positions of many of the people at Rand. Now, the question is, what happens in international affairs? And in that sense, they would adopted what would today be considered quite a conservative perspective.
Yeah. So I think I've heard you say not just that Rand was a progressive project, but that American foreign policy of the 20th century was a progressive project.
Very much so. In the idea that it's intended to manage world affairs through the use of reason and analysis.
And that is why I'm here in your house, because this is what I've been arguing for years and years. And I've heard almost no one say this, certainly in academia, for a long, long time. So when I heard you say this recently, I almost fell off my chair. But that's why I drove all the way to Seattle to talk to you.
Oh, well, that's great. Thank you.
So... But let's make the argument instead of just asserting it. So, well, that's a pretty big piece of it. Rand, everyone agrees, is at least one of the most important think tanks in foreign policy of the last 50 years.
Oh, absolutely.
Everyone agrees on that.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, you show in the book and in what you've just said that it was dominated by left-wingers of a particular kind,
yep.
Social democratic, not communist, not socialist, certainly not in a revolutionary way, but they're interested in, they might be similar to Bernie Sanders or Democratic Socialists of America in terms of economic and domestic politics. But then on foreign policy, they are the biggest hawks in American history and are responsible for the deaths of millions of civilians and Agent Orange and the nuclear bomb and the Vietnam War and the Korean War, and it goes on and Iraq and all of it, right? So what the fuck.
Well, I mean, I think it's important to
disaggregate.
Because,
wait a second. Sorry.
No,
because we all know, right, that people who want to feed the poor are good people. So why would they then turn around and kill poor people?
Well, this is, I think, the problem of actual American imperialism and hegemony in practice. I would also say it's not quite right. I would say they blended into what became known as Cold War liberalism, which is sort of an ideological formation that doesn't quite exist in the same way today in 2018 that it did in the 1940s and 1950s, which is the idea that you could have a social democratic politics economically and what might be considered a hawkish foreign policy. But I think it's also important to understand that even though they did have these social democratic politics, they very much didn't consider to be didn't consider the major struggle of the age to be about capitalism or about communism. So in that sense, I think it's important to disaggregate what they were confronting. So for them, it was really the struggle between democracy and what they called mm-hmm. totalitarianism. So social democratic politics actually for them was a third order concern by the 1940s and 1950s. Mm-hmm. So even though Speier considered himself a social democrat, I also think it's important to understand that he didn't think that challenging capitalism was the most important thing to do in 1950. The most important thing to do was prevent World War III.
Right.
And so I think it's important to put these people in their historical context so we don't come off as blaming social democrats for example, Vietnam.
Not just preventing World War III, but preventing the spread of totalitarianism,
right,
whether it was fascism or communism.
Right, which right? I think is a very problematic analytical term.
But that was their main concern, wasn't it?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so that, you know, we can be, and I think you are, somewhat sympathetic, at least to that concern, right?
Oh, I mean, it makes total sense at the time. Yeah. I mean, I think you have to be empathetic with these historical figures and see what were they doing in 1948? What was the experience of 1948? It's not the experience of 2018, you know? And so you have to take that into account as an analyst.
Let's spend a second on the end of the story and then go back to the beginning of the story.
Sure.
So the end of the story, is it not the neocons? Is that the end of this, of the Hans Speier story? It's neoconservatism?
It's very much neoconservatism. I mean, it's a very close connection. So for example, one of Speier's colleagues at Rand was a man named Albert Wallstetter, famously Paul Wolfowitz's advisor at the University of Chicago. And a lot of these people who became the generation of neocons that helped get us into Iraq were the daughters and sons, literally in terms of like the academic sense of these first generation of defense intellectuals, which I think is a perversion of the experience that actually led the defense into the first generation, people like Speier and Hans Morgenthau, et cetera, to make the arguments they did. And then were sort of taken forward and helped lead to this very interventionist foreign policy in Vietnam and beyond.
Right. So a lot of us who have been hating the neocons for a long, long time have always known that those guys started off on the left, either as serious socialists, Trotskyists, or at least social democrats, right? And then became,
right.
And then moved into government, and they moved, a lot of them moved into, this is going to draw a bunch of connections at once, into Henry Jackson, the senator from Washington's right. office, literally, who was the hawkish New Deal liberal senator from Boeing, he was called.
Famous name, yeah.
And you are now a professor in the Henry Jackson School of, what's it called?
International
World
Studies.
World Death? International Studies, right.
No, not called World Death. But I think just a point of clarification, it's more true of the first generation of defense intellectuals that they went from the left to the right. By the Wolfowitz generation, the Feith generation, they pretty much start out on the right, I would say the right flank of liberalism.
Wolfowitz never did, he was never a lefty at all?
Never a lefty.
Really?
Most of that generation was not. So I think it's important to emphasize that because the lessons one draws are different.
Right, so let's just be real clear here. So I think the two generations you're talking about, there's the first generation, which would be like Irving Kristol,
right.
Norman Podoritz.
Exactly.
Those guys, the godfathers of neoconservatism.
Yeah, Hans Morgenthau, Hans Speier. Yeah.
And then the second generation would be the Wolfowitz, the Feiths, the
exactly.
people who actually went into the Bush White House.
Exactly.
After they were in Scoop
right.
Jackson's
Who started
office.
Out on the who was a right-wing Democrat.
Well, basically. But no, hang on, no. I think you're wrong.
Well, I'm far
about
policy.
Something. Hang on. But wasn't, I mean, Scoop Jackson's perfect, right? Because wasn't he was a New Dealer, basically, wasn't he?
Yeah, but he also
semi-social democrat.
Japanese Americans.
As did everybody, though. Everybody was for that.
He was one of the
leaders.
Not great.
He was enthusiastic
he
about
was enthusiastic,
interning the Japanese.
Which I think would put you on the right of the Democratic Party, even in the context of the 1940s. I wouldn't say that's necessarily a centrist position.
Virtually, even the Communist Party supported it, internment.
So virtually, the leadership of the Communist
virtually
Party.
Virtually no one opposed internment. Virtually no one.
I would recommend, there's a project out here that's been doing some interesting historical research on a subject that's often been overlooked. And I think there was more resistance than we have been taught, which is very interesting. A good follow on Twitter is Natasha Varner, who's a part of this project, who's been doing this reappraisal of this moment.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, in terms of like public officials, though, I can tell you
I think
pretty
that's
confidently.
True. I think that's true. Yeah, I agree.
And this is not even important. It's not. Yeah. So Scoop Jackson, though, and that was his name. He was known by Scoop. He was more or less a social democrat, wasn't he?
I mean,
of a Bernie Sanders sort.
Yes, but he also, let's say he was in favor of labor unions. I would say he was very much one in favor of labor unions, but there were lots of problems with labor unions in the 30s and 40s in terms of race politics and gender politics and things along those lines.
Yeah, but he was probably for the, you know, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, that whole package?
For certain elements of the population, for certain.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be fair, I say, to draw a one-to-one comparison between him and Bernie.
But he was certainly a liberal.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He was a liberal in the context of the
1930s. And today we would call that kind of liberalism progressivism because it's a little to the left of the Democratic Party now. Correct?
In terms of union policy, for sure.
Scoop Jackson.
Of the official Democratic
Party. Was to the left of the current Democratic Party.
And labor on questions of economic redistribution for white people, yes.
Yeah, well, so, right. So Wolfowitz, I think, started off at least a liberal, didn't he?
It wasn't his major concern. Okay. I mean, because this is the problem with American politics when there's two parties and then you wind up in these enormous 10 parties.
Right.
Did Wolfowitz give a shit? Can we curse?
Yeah, please.
Did Wolfowitz give a shit about economic policy? Not really. What Wolfowitz cared about was building the American empire abroad.
Yeah, he just didn't devote. I mean, I don't even know what Wolfowitz, none of us know.
Right.
He doesn't talk about it.
Right, because he doesn't care about
but
it.
But my guess is on economics and domestic policy, he'd vote Democrat.
Yeah, that's probably true.
Okay.
I guess. Yeah. I mean, I don't.
So it's all progressivism.
Especially in the 60s and 70s.
So the lineage of all of it is progressivism, basically. It's all connected to that strand of political thought. It's not Burkean conservatism. It's not.
No, it's certainly
it's
not.
It's not Taft conservatism.
No, it's not Burkean conservatism.
It's not
conservatism.
Buckley conservatism either. This is its own thing, which is all goes back to the progressives of the early 20th century, right?
Well, in the sense, when I make that point about progressivism, what I'm referring to is the idea that there are these large macro things that science is able to manage. Things like capital E economy, things like capital NS national security.
Yeah.
That was an invention of the progressives. So in the sense that Wolfowitz thought there was something called national security that the United States could manage by applying the scientific method to the study of international affairs, he was a progressive. But this doesn't mean that Wolfowitz participated in what I would call the good aspects of progressive, egalitarianism, equality, democracy, in fact, very anti-democratic, right? Because progressivism has different strands. It has Walter Lippmann and it has John Dewey, mm-hmm. and they have very different answers to the problems of things like public opinion. So I think then you have to call it just a progressive project. What I like to do is drill down on what exactly is meant by
that. Oh yeah, I'm not saying they're exactly the same. I'm saying that, but they are part of the same lineage.
Yes, broadly speaking.
The tree of progressivism,
that
I suppose.
Management of affairs is a thing that people are capable of doing.
And scientific management.
And science. Particular. Yes,
yeah,
exactly.
You nail the way you describe progressivism is almost exactly the way I describe it.
Yeah, which is, I think that's its legacy today.
Not only it's a belief that scientific management of humanity is possible, but desirable.
Right. Well, desirable, yes. And then this gets into possible. Yeah, and possible. Right. And this gets into larger questions of coercion and management and hierarchy.
It sure does.
Yes.
On a pretty big scale, the 20th century tells us.
Exactly.
So Hans Speier is it fair to say, a major part of the bridge between early 20th century progressivism and the neoconservatism that we live with now?
I think that's a perfect and apt description.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, let's go back to the beginning.
Yes.
This Hans Speier cat. So give us the early story and his early thinking is key to the whole story. Yeah. And I think this is the most interesting thing. And I actually want to challenge you maybe a bit on this.
No,
not that you're wrong about your description of him, but that I think it might pose, I think it does, and I think you're actually aware of this, pose some problems for your very own thinking about politics.
Yeah, no.
The Hans Speier early history.
Sure. So he basically starts off life as a social democrat and believes that the main purpose of an intellectual in Weimar Germany is to educate the working classes.
Sorry, just back up. Just more like born where and when?
Oh, sure. Born 1905, Berlin, is an adolescent during the end of World War
One. Class background is?
Class background, middle class. Father worked for the New York and insurance company.
Upper middle, right?
I would say until the 20s when his father gets Parkinson's disease.
Gotcha.
And then, so upper middle as a child, but then middle to lower middle as an adult and an adolescent. As an adolescent and young adult. So there's a class falling there, mm-hmm. basically in Speier's life, which classic way to bring people to
socialism.
And
the mother was sick too, right?
Mother was sick too.
Right.
Basically what we would call depressed. She had chronic depression, tried to commit suicide. I left this out of the book, but Speier once walked in on her overdosing on pills, uh-huh. I believe, and then had to take her to the hospital. So traumatic childhood, managing his parents to some degree and their diseases. Becomes a socialist as a very, actually a form of rebellion, went to an imperialist school because we remembered the German Empire made illegal in 1918, 1919, founding of the Weimar Republic, but still a lot of monarchists still in Germany.
His father was Prussian, correct?
And his father was Prussian with the largest state in Germany. Now a lot of it is part of Poland, so it's not even on the map. So you have to go back to pre-World War II Germany to see what Prussia was.
Big fan of discipline.
Big fan of
Well, you say that in the book.
Yeah, no, and that's what Speier said. Yeah, big fan of discipline. And so as an act of rebellion, Speier actually is aligned with the Social Democratic Party of Germany, which is one of the major parties in defense of democracy, right? Because it's difficult to remember, and this is why I think the Nazi analogy doesn't work when we're talking about 2018 America, is that democracy itself as a political form was something that was questioned by a lot of people in 1920s Germany. Mm-hmm. That literally the idea that you couldn't trust the demos to make political decisions. The socialists were the ones who most vociferously defended the structures of the Democratic Republic mm-hmm. throughout the Weimar period, 1918 to 1933, and Speyer aligns with this political movement.
Okay, so just pause here. So, so the Social Democratic Party in Germany during this period in the 20s and 30s, early 30s, is the Social Democratic, it's the SPD.
SPD.
Okay, so just so people know.
Sure.
And it is this very strange conglomeration, right? Yeah. At the point, right? There's sort of, there's kind of these, what we would now call maybe liberals, and then right. also pretty hardcore socialists right. like Speyer, although who's not in the SPD at this point, right, is the revolutionary socialists.
People who believed in violent revolution.
Overthrow of the government.
Violent overthrow right. of the government.
Like capital C communists.
Capital C communists, who literally believe that that violent revolution, seizure of the means of the state, the dictatorship of the right. proletariat, that is a communist position yeah. and is not a the position of the SPD. So you could be very left-wing in the SPD, but you want to do it through what are called at the time reformist, or I would really call them democratic means. You want these to have a democratic base, not be imposed on the public from above.
Okay, so let's do this old, old, old argument that I used to have when I was a socialist back in the 19th century.
Let's do it.
Because it's key to the story here. So there's this split, kind of one of the big splits among socialists during this time in the early 20th century is between the revolutionary wing, kind of led by the Leninists on the one hand, the Bolsheviks, Trotsky, et cetera, who say, yeah, we need a violent revolution. We need to do it right now, wherever it can happen. If it's going to be Russia, it's going to be Russia, even though it's an agrarian society. And Marx said it would be an industrial society. Fuck it, we're going
to
go.
Well, Marx said some things toward the end of his life that, as you know, that people could point to.
Sure.
Yeah.
But that, and then-
Yeah, he's not a holy text.
And so they hate maybe even more than capitalists. They hate these SPD types like your Hans Speyer guy, right. but the intellectual leader of that democratic, it's called democratic socialist movement is this dude, Edward Bernstein, right?
Earlier in the 20th century.
Very yeah. famous, at least among socialists, intellectual, who advocated for basically what Bernie Sanders and Democratic Socialists of America are doing now, which is parliamentary socialism through parliamentary reform and parliamentary right. means.
And right? he believed, I think it's critical, is that that was kind of inevitable. And this is the big problem that the socialists confront in the 20s.
Okay.
So Bernstein is like, when there is democracy, there will be socialism, right? It's sort of a functional yep. relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. So socialism for all of them is economic democracy.
Economic democracy, but also cultural democracy. Like sure. they had a much more expansive understanding of what a political movement was. Mm-hmm. So you have, it's not just economic democracy, which of course is the foundation of it, but also there are cultural organizations for mm-hmm. socialists. There mm-hmm. are social organizations in addition to political organizations. So it's a true capital M movement. So the SPD was just the political wing of the larger socialist movement.
Right.
And so it's an expansive definition.
Right. So here's the problem both wings faced, the people.
Right.
Was the problem.
Right.
And this is what you talk about extensively in the book.
It's a serious problem.
And yeah. elsewhere, right? The problem is that most people in Russia, most people in Germany, certainly most people in the United States weren't socialists and right. still aren't, never have been. There's right. never been a majority in any country really who are really socialists, right?
Right.
And so what do you do about that? Now, the Leninists, the revolutionaries said, well, at least many of them did, including my parents who were Trotskyists. They said, oh, well, the working class, yeah, they watch TV too much and they don't even know what socialism is. So what they need is they need us, people like us, to lead them, you know, in the right direction to make them revolutionaries. And that's called the vanguard or vanguardist right. ideology or right. vanguardism. We will be the vanguard of the working class. It's a Leninist, classic Leninist revolutionary position, which has been right. debated among socialists too, but that was their basic position.
Right.
So it's, you know, I think, I would hope at least the audience for this show would see that as problematic in all kinds of
it's
ways.
It's extremely problematic. Yeah. And okay. it's anti-egalitarian
yeah.
and it's, against it's, anti-democratic.
Sort of flagrantly elitist. Yeah. yeah. But on the other side, these democratic socialists like Speyer and Bernstein are saying, well, they're going to have to vote for us, right? We're going to run for office and then we're going to institute all these socialist programs, but they're going to have to vote for us, which means they have to learn to vote for the right person.
Right. And so it's very focused on an educational vision of social and political change.
Hence all the cultural programs that they had. Right? When you said programs. It was also a cultural movement, I said, yes, absolutely, because they understood that the working class needed to be educated.
Right. And it is always an issue.
Now, Daniel, how is that not vanguardism?
Well, it's vanguardism in a sense, and in the sense that, like, if you believe that humans tend toward community, as I do, I think that's a fact of human nature, that the Robinson Crusoe model of human existence is just not empirically or historically true. And humans tend toward community, that communities necessarily have hierarchies. And it's the degree of hierarchy and coercion in society that I think is crucial here. So for people like Speier and Bernstein, they were considering themselves to be intellectuals and therefore able to see the social totality, which again is an elitist perspective. So there's an elitism inherent to these politics, but the elitism was in the service of this larger social political project. I mean, I for one believe that all social forms have hierarchy. Uh-huh. And I think it's historically naive and untrue to think otherwise. And this would be my critique of the Robinson Crusoe model of the
Libertopia. So basically you're the only socialist academic fan of Jordan Peterson. Is that what's happening here?
I'm absolutely not a fan of Jordan Peterson. Hard no, but I think socialists would accept that too, even though I think that socialists, of course, are anti-hierarchy is in the principle, but I think everyone today would recognize that the complete horizontal organization of something like Occupy Wall Street was inherently problematic.
Right.
So the question is, how do you square the commitment to democracy and egalitarianism, which is a true value, with the realities of that in the existing society of the 20th and 21st centuries? Hierarchy is necessary to political organization.
Right. So one of the central pieces of your book is your description of Speier holding to this idea for basically his entire life, mm-hmm. that the people need experts to rule them.
Right. And expertise is a crucial way to manage the increasingly complex world in which we live. Remember the 20s, the rise of the radio, the rise of mass printing, the rise of mass-based political parties, experiential propaganda. The world's becoming more complex, and so you need people who are experts in particular areas in order to manage these affairs.
Right. You have the populations of all the countries growing exponentially in some cases, right? We just have way more people now. We have more machines than ever.
Urbanization.
Everything's more complicated, more technological. Everything's more difficult to figure out. So we need experts like you and me who have PhDs, right?
Right. Something along those lines.
Well, because you do say many times that you agree with Speier to some extent. You do say that we do need experts, don't we?
Yeah, I think that if you don't have experts, as a great historian Bruce Kucklick said, you leave decisions to habit, authority, or chance. Mm-hmm. So in this particular historical moment, I don't see how you get beyond that, because it's obviously a utopian to say you could have a democratic, pure democratic, right. One person, one vote on every decision in society. It just doesn't work that way.
Okay, we'll get to that later.
Sure.
So I love Speier and there were others like him in Germany, these German intellectuals at the time, and American intellectuals were doing the same thing. The argument they made for why they should lead the people was that by virtue of being intellectuals, they were above, in a sense, class and other status dividers. They could sort of float, right? Because they live in the mind. So they're Luftmenschen. They're in the air above us. They're not of working class or not of the upper class.
Right.
They just float around and think and look, right? That's what you and I do.
Right. So this is
so therefore we can see what everyone needs. We can see what everyone needs.
Yeah, right? And do you have a problem? I mean, do you disagree? No, I think that the issue is they're dealing in a world that's very informed by Marxist class analysis, and intellectuals don't quite fit into any of the traditional classes of Marxist social theory.
Isn't that funny? Because all the Marxists I've ever known were intellectuals.
Well, which is, back then, that's not true.
Most of them were.
Certainly in the post-war United States. But so this is a big problem for Marx. And Marx actually writes about this.
By the way, sorry, Speier was a Marxist, right?
Yeah. Speier was a Marxist.
A Bernsteinian democratic socialist variant of a Marxist. But
yeah, left-wing Bernsteinian might be a way to refer to him. But I mean, Marx deals with this too. And Marx says intellectuals like Marx could cross classes, you know? So there's this always idea is that many of the advocates for the working classes were themselves come from bourgeois, I mean, famously Engels, right? Mm-hmm. You know, from a bourgeois background. But the idea is, the question that everyone's asking is, what is the role of the intellectual in society in this context?
Right.
And as you just said, the answer is we float above it all and we mm-hmm. can see it all. So therefore we could lead. Yeah.
The self-justification is just awesome.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Absolutely.
So Speier becomes a socialist in rebellion against his parents when he's what, like a teenager?
Yeah, 15.
Okay.
And when doesn't take the confirmation blessing, things like that.
And your parents were not socialists.
No, my parents were and are not.
And you, but you became a socialist too.
I became a socialist.
Slightly later than Speier?
I think I identified politically as a socialist in graduate school. as I learned more about it. Post 2008, like many people of my generation, you know, growing up in the 1990s, Cold War triumphalism, capitalism is necessarily triumphant and it will clearly make the world a better place. But the obvious falsity of those claims became clearer after Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, the 2008 financial crisis. I began looking for political alternatives that seemed to deal with the actual problems that we face today. And for a variety of reasons, I embraced socialism.
Was it, it was Occupy and the financial crisis that did it for you?
Was
that
I was already tending towards more egalitarian principle. Okay. I mean, I always had equalitarian sympathies and egalitarian sympathies. I've considered myself a feminist since I was an early teenager. So I was always attracted to political ideologies that seemed to promise more and not less freedom. And it seemed over time, you know, as an early flirtation with libertarianism, as I think many white men in this country go through in high school.
Which I completely missed, by the way. I didn't even know about libertarians until I was 45.
No, so after sort of passing through that, I really came to see, as Corey Robin recently argued in the Times magazine, that socialism is really the greatest way to achieve freedom for most people in this historical moment.
Yeah. So here's what I'm thinking. I'm thinking that you are a socialist. You're in your 20s. You're in grad school. You think it's a good thing, as did I. And I know the feeling of being a socialist. I know it well because I was one for a long, long time. And then you come across not only this guy, Hans Speier, but you come across a whole group of people who he was associated with who are also socialists, at least at some point, who now are the devil. In your world, right? They're the ones who are running amok right at the moment when you're becoming a socialist. They're the ones killing all these brown people all over the world.
You mean like Wolfowitz and sort of their grandchildren.
Their progeny.
Yeah, their progeny.
Speier's
yeah.
progeny, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
And so I can imagine you're thinking, what happened here? My beautiful politics, the people who upheld it are the worst people now. So is that the origin of this project? You were trying to figure out how the best could become the worst?
To some degree, I think a more direct origin would just be the fact that I interned at the Council on Foreign Relations my senior year of college. And this was this is 2006, the spring of 2006. So like right before the surge, we're in Iraq, everyone's listening to people, I believe. At the time, Noah Feldman was there and he was one of the writers of the Iraqi Constitution. And so there's these sort of elite intellectuals.
Yeah, hang on, sorry, this is amazing. So you were not really political at the time, right?
I mean, I would have, no, not consciously so, not consciously so.
So why on earth did you get an internship at CFR?
Because the elite reproduces itself and I went to Columbia. And so they hired someone who went to Columbia.
But how did they recruit you?
I was the, I don't know if you remember this, you are also a fellow Columbia guy. At the beginning of every year, you would receive a guidebook, the Columbia Inside New York guidebook. I was one of the publishers of that. Oh. And so I got an intern in the publication division of the Council on Foreign Relations by virtue of the fact that I had this book.
And you just thought it was cool because they were—
I was always interested in foreign policy. Okay. I mean, growing up Jewish, you know, Israel is always on the docket and always in the equation. And so it was always an interest, a passive interest of mine. And then you're graduating college. I knew I didn't want to be a lawyer. I knew I didn't want to, I was definitely not going to be a doctor. And I knew I probably didn't want to work a 9-to-5 job. It just wasn't in my constitution. So I was thinking about what I could do. And so I was thinking about foreign policy and foreign policy making. And I applied for this internship at CFR.
And did you work at the offices?
Yeah. I worked in the offices.
On 68th. They moved.
68th and Madison, I think.
They used to be on 65th for a long, long time.
Yeah, maybe it was 65th.
No. Yeah. I think they did move. But anyway, so 65th, the original offices were on E65th and it is a townhouse. And,
yes, it is a townhouse.
And do you know the story about this?
I did at the time. It was like
I've said this publicly before, but like, so there's a townhouse, right? And so all the houses are connected to each other, right? Yeah. On this row. And do you know who the occupants of the house next door to CFR's headquarters was for like 50 years was Eleanor and Franklin Roosevelt.
Yeah, so it's something
they
like
shared
that.
Literally yeah. shared a wall with the CFR.
And so you see the progressive origins in that, you know, like very much
there
Woodrow Wilson calls the Council on Foreign Relations. I mean, he was a right-wing progressive, you know, there are different types of progressives, but a progressive project.
Yep. There you go.
Yeah,
there
right
you go.
There.
And CFR was the intellectual think tank, pretty much the only one before World War II. And they were pushing as hard as anybody possibly could to get the United States into war in the Pacific and in Europe,
but not
all through the 30s.
I think it's also critical to recognize not a think tank in the way that we think about it. They weren't producing like analysis and reports. That innovation is really with Rand. They're much more what would have been called like a civic lobbying organization, like the Institute for Specific Studies and the Council on Foreign Relations and the Brookings Institution, part of this broader elite of lawyers and business people who are circulating. They all go to Groton, they all go to Phillips, then they go to Harvard, then they go to Yale, and they're all talking to each other.
Right.
The meritocratic elite that we think of as the quote unquote think tank is really RAND, which is we're going to get these smart guys. They're going to use science and they're going to study international affairs and come up with objective analysis. So CFR and Brookings reframe themselves after the success of RAND. So there's this split in the 40s that I just wanted, as a historian, I want to emphasize.
So that's really helpful to me. Okay. Okay, because I've been studying the CFR for about 2 years now.
It's very interesting.
And I didn't know the story about the post-war. Okay, so this makes sense now to me. Okay, so CFR until World War II, you're right, was all these guys from Groton. They literally all had the same headmaster. This
literally.
Dude, Endicott Peabody, who's super famous and important. And Harvard and Yale and Columbia. They all were from the same neighborhoods and families. You're right. It wasn't a meritocracy at all. And Roosevelt's sort of a perfect exemplar of this,
exactly.
Right? Then, so therefore it's not actually progressive in a real sense. And they're kind of aware of it in a way, right? Because progressivism is truly about scientific rationality. And so that's not scientific or rational just to have the rich people run the country.
Right.
So even they're not going to give up their positions of power, but I would imagine what's happening in part during the war is they start to give...
They let go of that a bit, and they
start to say, wait, to be real progressives, we need to just let the best scientists run stuff.
Which is one of the biggest unanswered...
Right?
It's right, and okay. It's one of the biggest unanswered questions in American history is why did the WASP elite give up its power?
Yeah.
It's one of the biggest transformations in American political history, and there's not a satisfactory answer. Because basically, meritocracy didn't kill the WASP elite, which continues to exist, of course, but it definitely removed it from a lot of the levers
of
power.
Right.
It's an enormous question that I don't think we have a satisfactory answer to.
Okay, so when I read your book and I came to that part where you said RAND was the first, basically, think tank, and I was like, what the fuck's wrong with this guy? CFR was way before them, but now it's way more interesting and important, and I think you're onto something.
I believe I said first modern think tank, I believe was the phrase.
Well, that helps. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. But also, here's what I want to say. The first modern, truly progressive think tank.
Right, in the sense of merit, again, like in the sense of science.
Which went on to kill millions.
Right. Which is a problem inherent in the project.
Yeah.
Right. And because it's a progressivism, there's no such thing as objective science, right? It's always attached to an ideological position, especially objective social science, I would say.
Wait, they don't think that. You and I think that about them, but they don't think that about themselves.
No, they don't think that. I'm talking about how does RAND wind up killing X amount of Vietnamese?
It's its own ideology. It's infinite, right? There is no horizon.
Right.
In a sense, right? There's no end to it.
And this is the problem with people like Sam Harris who argue in favor of capital R rationality is there's no such thing. Rationality, like everything, is historically contingent. We're all fallen human beings, to use a religious metaphor, and there's no way to get above that. And so this is a significant problem with the Petersons, with the Harrises, et cetera. They reify rationality as something outside history, which is naive and just flat incorrect.
Yay. standing ovation for that. I think Peterson's a little more complicated. I do not want to talk about Jordan Peterson here, but I do think this new crop of these new atheists, it's not just Harris, it's
right.
The whole new atheist they didn't just throw out God. They also, it was a wholehearted embrace of this progressive rationality.
A naive epistemology.
And therefore their particular interesting positions on foreign policy make some sense, don't they?
Right. No, it makes total sense.
Christopher Hitchens, Sam Harris. Yeah. Gee, it's funny how they're all super interventionist.
Anti-Islamic, you know, very, very.
It's not because these idiots on the left who call them Islamophobes completely miss the point here.
No, that's not the source of their is anti-Islamism.
Which is the problem they have is that Islam is irrational.
Right.
Therefore, it has to be done away with.
Right. And it's just an ahistorical position. I mean, just to get slightly in the weeds, the secular religious divide that occurred in the West in the Middle Ages never quite occurred the same way in the Muslim world. So it's an anti-historical position to like equate Islam as a religion akin to Christianity. It's just not taking it on its own actually existing historical terms.
Right.
And which is another like very significant problem with the whole approach to the thing.
Right. Yeah. Islam is also inefficient. Right.
Oh, that's what they say.
You know,
yeah,
so that's a problem. That's absurd. We'll never have a perfectly efficient society so long as we have these bad ideas.
Yeah, it's absurd. Yeah.
So Speier is really important here. Here's the thing that I don't like about Speier, or at least it makes it he's difficult for me to put into my boxes in this way. This is really funny. I'm sure you had the same problem. He's not Jewish.
No.
What the hell? They're all Jewish. Well, how come he's not Jewish?
Right. So
he marries a Jew though. Right?
He marries a Jew and he's a philo-Semite. And I don't know if you've ever heard the phrase.
Wow. So he sort of like publicly, actively loves Jews and Judaism and Jewish culture?
Yeah, to the degree that at the end of his life, he basically thought that he came from Jewish origins. to the degree that, like, how the hell am I not Jewish? But it's this interesting character, and I don't know if you're familiar with Yuri Slezkin's book, The Jewish Century, but there's, or George Mossy's, no, it wasn't Mossy, I forget who, but there was a famous, maybe Sala Baron, but there was a famous Jewish historian who argued about the non-Jewish Jew, who was a Jew who was very much inflected by non-Jewish culture, sure. And Speyer might be the opposite. He's the Jewish non-Jew in the sense that his milieu was totally Jewish. Both of his advisors in graduate school were Jewish. He socialized almost exclusively with Jews from the 30s onward.
There it is.
So it's this milieu, this Jewish intellectual milieu that Speyer participates in. And I think it's also just important to, for us as historians, of course, to not to apply the categories of 2018 onto those of the 1920s and 1930s, where identities could be more or less fluid depending on where you were.
Okay. So back to my brilliant speculation about you and the inner workings of your mind.
Yeah, please.
Was I right at all about this, about how you were a socialist and you came across these socialists doing terrible things and needed to understand why?
No, because they weren't socialists. I mean, that generation wasn't socialist.
Well, ex-socialists.
Well, I didn't know that. So what I did was, what I was surprised to find in the course of my research is how many of these people started on the left. And how many of the first generation? Again, the first generation.
Was it troubling? Was it puzzling? What was it when you discovered that all these evil people started off with your politics?
That's not troubling because the trauma of Nazism is so extreme that it actually explains quite a lot. Mm-hmm. I feel like and this is my problem with people who still make this analogy is that it's so sui generis to some degree. The Nazism, the fall of the Weimar Republic into World War II and into the Holocaust, I could see that how that could truly traumatize a generation of people to become incredibly pessimistic about democracy, incredibly pessimistic about quote unquote ordinary people.
Sure.
So it's actually not that, it didn't trouble my politics at all because it was such an extreme thing that happened to them, is what I would say.
So I'm not totally sure about that. Let's talk about this for a second here. So the big theme, in a sense, in the book here is that Speyer gives up. A big theme here in the book is that Speyer, in a sense, gives up on the people.
Right.
He gives up. He stops believing at all that they will make the right decisions. And Nazism, the rise of Nazism, and the popular support that Hitler had is proof that they are not to be trusted and need experts to lead them. And he and people like him are the people to do that. Okay. And so you don't give him a pass, but you're at least sympathetic because of the
empathetic.
Because of the trauma, and you know that's some pretty serious evidence there because it's true. It was a democracy. Weimar was a democracy. Hitler did rise to power in a democracy. No one voted for him directly, but you know it was a democratic system. And but Speyer could have known that the Nazis never had more than 10 or 15% of the population that was truly supporting them, right? I mean,
I believe it's higher than that. I used to know these numbers, but in the September 32 elections, I think maybe they had 28%.
Oh, but I mean, like that. Okay, fine.
Yeah,
the most.
No,
right?
No, not a majority.
Not even close.
Absolutely not a majority.
Not even close. And I mean,
right. And we're losing by the time Hitler was appointed chancellor.
And
we're
the historian Richard Evans, I think his name is,
yes.
Who's a major historian of Nazism, has said recently that he estimates that it's something like, I don't know, 1 in 10 were actual true Nazis who really subscribed to the ideology, who were members of the party. It's a small minority, right?
Absolutely.
90% of the Wehrmacht, and this is a fact that I scream all the time because it pisses me off so much that people miss this, 90% plus of the Wehrmacht was drafted, was conscripts. Mm-hmm. So when people talk about German soldiers being Nazis, I start to throw stuff at them. It's really infuriating. But so Speyer could have known a lot of this or most of this, right? Mm-hmm. And he could have said, well, as a matter of fact, the people didn't choose Nazism.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't.
Right.
Just like the people didn't choose Donald Trump, did they?
Right.
Far, far more people did not vote for Donald Trump than did.
Right.
Far more.
Like, right. And 40% of Americans didn't vote at all.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the hyper alienation.
Yeah, my people, the non-voters, there's 100 million of us.
Right, exactly.
Just non-voters.
Which is probably the most important constituency in American politics. Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't know, man. Like,
so was Speyer wrong? Very, very well.
Okay,
I mean,
okay.
Yeah, I mean, sure. But that doesn't matter. What matters is the narratives that we tell ourselves.
But then why be empathetic?
Because it makes sense of your personal experience. You're seeing street fights in Berlin. You're seeing these massive Nazi rallies. There certainly wasn't heavy resistance to things like the Nuremberg laws. There wasn't heavy resistance to things like Kristallnacht. There wasn't heavy resistance to the remilitarization of Germany.
True.
The fighting of World War II. And certainly not enough resistance to the Holocaust.
But that's because he had killed all the resistance.
And what do you mean by that?
I mean, what's depressing?
I mean, the anti-socialist point to really make is how quickly the Nazis incorporated German labor, and that how quickly they were able to like incorporate ordinary people into the broad, you know, Gleichschaltung of the Nazi state.
Fair enough. I mean, this is sort of standard history, but you know, I mean, the first thing Hitler does is he kills or incarcerates or exiles all the communists
and makes
all
the socialists illegal.
Yeah, yeah. Tosses the SPD out, et cetera. Right. But then, and this is what I've been working on mostly, is the everyday resistance sort of by ordinary Germans to the discipline of the regime, to the demands of the regime. And the regime is drowning from day one, trying to get all these Aryan people, supposedly, right, to do what Aryans are supposed to do.
And that's the cutting edge of research. You see how little the state actually, which is actually even scarier, the fact that the state didn't infiltrate into all these people's lives, but it was nonetheless able to prosecute World War II in the Holocaust.
Well, I think most people just weren't aware of a lot of it and or uninterested.
I'm not up on this literature, but my sense is that a lot of Germans were actually aware of what was going on with the Jews.
I don't think so. Since the Goldhagen thesis, I think that's been pretty much put.
Yeah, the elimination of anti-Semitism, I think, is not correct. But I thought it was Jan
Gross. Just so people
Gross's,
know, Daniel Goldhagen wrote this infamous book about 20 years ago. It was when I was in grad
school. Hitler's
Willing
Executioner.
Yeah, in which he argues that it was basically, you know, Hitler had huge popular support, and since then it's been pretty thoroughly debunked. Right.
That has been debunked.
Okay.
Yes, but I think there was awareness of this broad anti-Jewish and even murderous program. I'm pretty sure that is the consensus of the new literature. Pretty sure.
Okay, but I mean, again, like to say that it was democracy, and I'm not a fan of democracy, by the way. I think Speier, I wouldn't even give him any credit for this at all. I just think it's wrong.
Like, well, it's,
most it, Germans, in fact, love Jews. Most Germans had Jewish doctors.
And they
were really pissed off when they got syphilis in 1944 and they no longer had a doctor to treat them.
I wouldn't feel safe saying most Germans loved Jews.
Loved,
I mean, Jews were a small part of the population.
Loved a Jew, loved Jews in some way.
I would say most Germans probably didn't know Jews or didn't have a relationship.
Jews were so much a part of that culture.
In certain cities, yes. But there was a lot of Germany that was certainly not in the cities at the time, particularly in South Germany.
Berlin, Hamburg, I mean, the big cities.
The big cities. But Jews were, I think, less than 3% of the population. I mean, someone could check me on this, but they weren't.
It was 500,000.
Yeah.
I know what the percentage was, but it was 500,000.
Yeah, but I think that's about 3% of the time. So it's not, there are many more Jews in Poland. And I mean, if you think most of the victims of the Holocaust were Eastern European
Jews. When I say
Jews.
Love Jews, I meant that they had like somewhat intimate relations in some regard with Jews.
I would say a fair amount of Germans had some sort of relationship. Yeah. Sure.
So Speier sees this and says, okay, see, this is proof that the people are stupid and they make the wrong decisions, not just stupid, but they make murderous decisions that will kill endless people. Right. So he still pays lip service to democracy. Still through his life, right? He never gives up, at least intellectually, on democracy.
Right, because it's always
so strange.
And this is what I think is so critical. And I think the big takeaway from my book is that how critical crisis is to enabling anti-democratic behavior by so-called Democrats. So what Speier does is he diagnoses crisis and he essentially says extraordinary measures are necessary in a crisis, but once the crisis is over, we could return to democracy. So in the 30s, this becomes once the Nazis are defeated, we could return to normal democratic functioning. After World War II, it becomes once the Soviets are defeated, we could return to democratic functioning. But obviously there are structural reasons the Soviets are never going to be defeated, most importantly, nuclear weapons that the Soviets get in 1949, but also the division of the world into a relatively stable bipolar system and the fact that there's psychological warfare. People think they don't need to fight a war. So what you have is the way I phrase it in my book is what's a moment of crisis in the 30s when the Nazis are truly able to be defeated turns into an era of crisis. So the entire post-war period, in my view at least, has been defined by extraordinary measures, particularly in foreign policy making, mostly because of this Cold War origin.
Right. So he gets this argument about the existential threat to the state justifies anti-democratic or even authoritarian or even totalitarian measures.
And using that language, explicitly.
He says this straight up.
Right.
This is Speier talking. But he's influenced in part, at least, by Carl Schmitt on this, correct?
So this is, I think it's important to emphasize, it's not influenced by Carl Schmitt. What happens is that a lot of people across Weimar's political spectrum had Schmitt's view of politics.
Okay.
So today, we trace this all to Schmitt and political political theology, this 1922 book, but in actuality...
A lot of people don't know who this is. So
Carl Schmitt was a famous political theorist in the 20s. In the early 30s, he associates with Nazism for a time and is basically tainted by his association with this fascist regime. But in 1922, he argued in this book, Political Theology, that the ultimate distinction of politics is that between friend and enemy, and that all politics comes from a pre-political moment, what he refers to as this primordial moment where people decide who's a friend and who's an enemy. And today, people say that Schmitt, and what Schmitt argued is that liberal democracies aren't effective in identifying this enemy and dealing with it, and they're naturally feckless and weak. People today say that this is Schmitt's critique, and it is Schmitt's critique, but it was also a lot of people's critique. So there was left-wing Schmittians, there were centrist Schmittians, and there were right-wing Schmittians. So the way I'd like to phrase it is that Speier and Schmitt agreed on this pre-political idea that politics is ultimately about the friend and enemy, and today a lot of people on the left are critiquing the Democratic Party for not recognizing what they consider to be this truth of politics.
Right.
But this was actually an idea that is not necessarily fascist in origin, but it's actually across the political spectrum.
Yeah, but there's the existential threat argument I was getting at, right?
That's. I mean, Speier has a review of Schmitt where he says this goes back to Marx.
Yeah, but again, the argument was the state current at this moment faces an existential threat.
Yes.
And when the state faces an existential threat, we should be totalitarian.
Extraordinary measures.
Is that correct? And that's Schmitt
correct.
Agrees with that. Correct.
Well, Schmitt criticized liberal democracy as saying this was Schmitt criticized liberal democracy because he said liberal democracies weren't able to do this. So Schmitt is not a Democrat.
Right.
Speier is a Democrat, right, using Schmittian arguments to justify these sorts of behaviors in liberal democracies, essentially arguing that Schmitt is wrong. Liberal democracies can take the necessary measures.
Schmitt kind of likes fascism.
Yeah. No, he aligns with the fascist party. Yeah.
And so did the progressives.
What do you mean by that?
I mean, the progressives in this country loved fascism in the 1920s and 30s.
Which progressives?
Until very late in the game, all of them.
Like, I would have to go, but certainly progressives like John Dewey, certainly progressives like Walter Lippmann. I think they were enamored with the Soviet Union for a time in the mid-20s to late 20s. I've never heard of their
slight overstatement, but not really. So John Diggins is the American historian who's written the book on this, and it's called, I think, The Intellectuals and Mussolini or something like that. It's about Charles Beard and that whole generation and Lippmann for a time. And the whole New Republic crowd, Crowley and all those guys, they are loving Mussolini. They're even loving German fascism for a time. You have the eugenicists who come out of progressivism who are going to Germany to teach the Germans how to do eugenics. This is well-established literature.
Yeah. I would agree that there are certainly strands, but I would say there are also strands very much not in favor. I mean, the real knock on them would be the interest in the Soviet Union, which lasts really until the early 30s. Even for some, it mostly ends with the Moscow trials, but really ends afterward. The fascination with Mussolini, I think, if I recall from Ben Alpers' book, is very short-lived, really 24 to 25, 26, 27. It's about managing, again, it's about managing these affairs through some sort of hyper-rational.
There are several members of the Roosevelt cabinet who are openly fans of Mussolini in the 1930s.
Right, because of the New Deal. And the New Deal. Yes.
Yeah. Corporatism.
If we're talking about that specific thing with sort of state-managed economies.
Yeah.
And what was that book just came out with Hitler's New Deal or something along those lines, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, yes, sure. Yeah. Okay. There were these transatlantic flows of state managed economies, but it's important to be specific and not to sort of paint the entire progressive project as being pro-fascist, which I don't
not
think is
pro-fascist, but related to fascism.
Or interested in sort of the state directed economics.
They're cousins of the fascists.
In certain elements of economic planning.
And rationality and the use of experts, the city manager model of progressivism, which is straight up,
so that's
experts managing cities instead of the mayor.
So this is the Horkheimer.
Which in fact, I think the city we're sitting in, I think is run by a city manager, an expert, right? Instead of an elected official.
Right. And this is sort of the idea that the Holocaust is the outcome of the Enlightenment. And then you get into this counter-Enlightenment philosophy that really Speier was part of, this sort of rejection of the Enlightenment progress narrative of the 20th century, which is inherent in how we think about
Speier it. Speier doesn't reject the Enlightenment. He embraces it and he carries it forward, doesn't he?
There's a really, it's filled with tension. So there's this counter-Enlightenment reaction. It's the idea that like progress is not necessarily inherent to human beings, which I think Speier and again, people like Hans Morgenthau and Henry Kissinger embrace in the 50s.
Okay.
And what is called as international relations realism, which I think is a philosophy, this brilliant book by Nicolas Guillot called After the Enlightenment, basically basically makes the case, I think very convincingly, that realism is a counter-Enlightenment philosophy in the sense that it rejects ideas of human progress. It thinks that sorts of like transformative political projects are unimaginable. Now, I think it's true that Nazism was a transformative political project, but I don't think the evils of that necessarily means that we should not consider transformative political projects.
Yeah. Okay. So the belief in inevitable upward progress
exactly.
for human beings is a part of the Enlightenment thinking, although I don't even think it's a major part. So on that, I would agree with you. Speier is reacting against that because he's saying, look, we just went down big time in the middle of the 20th century. But the rest of it that he's about is straight out of the Enlightenment, right? Rationality, science.
But he's not
meritocracy,
a particular type of rationale. And this is when the distinctions become true. He's not a game theorist. He's not a rational choice guy. He's an anti-quant guy, which I think is actually probably one of the greatest fonts of pieces of wisdom that Speier has, is that you need to engage with the concrete historical situation. And that, again, the rationality in the sense of reason is something that you need to analyze world affairs. You shouldn't just, again, make decisions by habit, authority, or chance. Mm-hmm. But he's very much not a game theorist in the John von Neumann, Oscar Morgenstern sense. So there's different elements of this rationality reason idea.
This is way more dangerous than the straight up quant guys.
In what sense?
Don't you think? I mean, if you're just doing math, right? I'm not too scared of you. But if you have these grand ideas about people who live all over the world and how they should live, I'm terrified of you.
Oh, no, he didn't. I mean, the democracy promotion stuff is something that comes later. This is not something that the first generation...
Well, but he wants to protect everyone from totalitarianism, doesn't he?
No, that he doesn't want to protect everyone from totalitarianism. Oh. He wants to ensure that the United States doesn't become totalitarian. This sort of expansive project that you're referring to is much more a second, third generation defense intellectual thing.
He is not a globalist?
No.
Until later.
Not in that sense. He's never a globalist in the
never.
Sense. He's never a globalist in the sense of we want to make Poland democratic. He never says we need to go and send military arms to Poland or we need to go make Vietnam democratic.
I guess I must have thought that was always implicit
no,
in his thinking.
That in my view as a historian is that is putting a view held by the grandchildren onto the fathers.
Okay.
The fathers were much more circumspect about the ability of the United States to do things like that abroad. Like the classical realists, Hans Morgenthau and people like that.
Yeah.
So this becomes perverted, I would agree, becomes perverted.
Kissinger being the most famous.
Kissinger's younger. Kissinger's born in 23.
But I'm just saying he's the most famous. That's what people might understand.
Right.
Kissinger is the most famous realist and he's
quote
also
unquote,
German
yeah.
and
yeah.
emigre and all that. So yeah. in that way, similar to Speier, Speier similar to Kissinger?
Yeah. And Speier, I think, is-
As a realist in that way?
Yeah. Speier, broadly speaking. Yeah. Broadly speaking.
Okay.
Sure.
But Kissinger's realism, let's talk about that for a second.
Sure.
Maybe I'm wrong about this. But I mean, to me, Kissinger still wants a Pax Americana, doesn't he? He wants a global American hegemon.
He wants a primate. I mean, this is gets into really the weeds of what's the difference.
Do you agree with that, by the way? Is that right?
He wants a primacist America.
America
that is able to exert its power where it wants. It's unclear to me whether he wants hegemony in the Gramscian sense of that America is able to do whatever it wants.
You're talking about Kissinger now.
Kissinger
yeah,
now.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
So, I mean, and this gets into the really the weeds of what is Kissinger and also like the ideology once you actually become a policymaker gets muddled. I mean, Kissinger very much is in favor of a more multilateral world than the one that existed in the 50s and the 60s. So I think one of the things that he viewed himself as doing, and also I should say, of course, obviously I'm anti-Kissinger in all the typical left-wing ways, but one of the things that he sees himself as doing is fostering a transition to a multilateral world. For example, opening up to China, coming to some sort of detente with the Soviet Union, at the same time, believing that America should be prime in the sense that America should be the overwhelming military power in the world.
Sure.
So there's a lot of complexities in his thoughts.
America should be able to do what it wants to
exactly.
do.
Exactly.
Everywhere.
He's not of the sort of Wolfowitzian, America goes into Iraq and makes it a democracy.
Right.
Very much
regime
not.
Change only when it's useful for us is right. what Kissinger's
and,
about,
and
right?
Maybe, and yeah, and also like-
And democracy, maybe not.
It.
Right.
Doesn't care.
If it serves
democracy.
Our interests, sure, but we don't care.
Yeah. And also, I think it depends on where you're looking at the world. So in Chile, the most famous example, right, it's a backwater to Kissinger. This is not a major game,
mm-hmm.
right? It means something different when you're talking about the East Germany, right? So there are also these complexities of different regions of the world that you're talking about.
But Chile was transformative. It was regime change. It was globalist.
Oh, absolutely.
So that, yeah. And that was Kissinger's deal.
He just didn't think it was important. I mean, this is the chauvinism of U.S. policymakers toward Latin America, which is a long tradition of U.S. foreign policy where they don't take the country seriously, and they're willing to be more risky there. For example, Wilson invading throughout the 1910s.
Yeah.
You know, it's and that goes back, as you're doing this long-term history, yeah. goes back to the founding of the Republic.
Yes, it does. Yeah.
So, I mean, and that's a peculiar relationship.
I'm still sort of thinking out loud about Henry Kissinger here.
Sure, yeah.
I mean, I'm not sold. I think he's still a globalist. I get that.
What do you mean by that?
I mean, I think they have different strategies. Sure. I think they differ over strategy, but I think he wanted the world to look more or less like the United States. I think he had this belief that formal liberal democracies were safer to deal with. And here's the thing. This is what I found in my research on the early part of the 20th century, and I'm sure you'll agree with this. I think you will. What I found at the CFR and in the State Department and in the Roosevelt administration, all the way back, I mean, before there was a Roosevelt administration, but the whole first half of the 20th century, they're talking constantly about this thing called autarky.
Right.
Right?
Yeah, right.
So they're really worried. First, they see, you know, Italy go, then they see Germany go, they see Japan go, they see these countries sort of close off to right. trade. That's the big one, right? Close off generally, but especially to trade. And they're saying, we can't allow this to happen because we need to trade, because we have all this industrial might. We have this production. We want to sell shit. And if we have a regime of, quote, free trade, we're going to win.
Right.
All the negotiations, all the deals that will be made in a truly free trade economy, global economy, the United States will come out on top because we're the richest, or we will be the richest by the end of this war.
Right. And they this is the William Appleman Williams.
This is argument. Your boys at the CFR. This is exactly what they were saying openly. Right. And this is well known.
Right, right, right. Right.
And so I think that's what unifies all these people.
I agree with that.
Speier, yeah. Kissinger, Woodrow Wilson, sure. yeah. Wolfowitz, all of them, yeah. right? Barack Obama, am I right? Clearly, yeah. all of them want that.
Yeah, no,
and they're,
I totally
and they're
agree.
Willing to kill just about anybody to get that, to make sure that the world is open for trade that the United States dominates. How's that? That sounds really communist, by the way, of me.
It's actually, you're making the new left argument.
I know. I am.
William Appleman Williams. I think it's a bit more, that's definitely a theme. Yes. I think when you're looking at specific policymakers and specific historical circumstances, who they are and are not willing to kill differs. They're much more willing to kill brown people. They're much more willing to
totally
kill Asian people.
See, I think that's wrong. You think that really?
So what would be an example? Give me a counter example.
All the dead Germans, the hundreds
of thousands.
Oh, you're
talking about World War II?
Yeah.
And
World War I?
Both World War I and World War II.
That's a lot of white
United
people.
States.
We killed a lot, and the Civil War. We killed a lot of white people.
Where did we drop the bombs?
We dropped a shit ton of bombs on people
and
in
Dresden,
Germany.
And yeah. specifically we wanted to do the firebombing. Yes, yes, there's this moment for
with
sure.
No, by the way, with no compunction, no hesitation at all. We loved killing us some Germans, didn't we?
Daniel Ellsberg's book is the new one, is really good
we
about.
We love killing Germans. We still love killing Germans. We have we now make movies in which we kill a whole bunch of Germans and everybody feels good about it, right?
Well, we kill Nazis.
Well, exactly.
Well,
did you see Dunkirk?
I did see Dunkirk, yeah.
Right, so I'm furious. I mean, still, right? It's like people just love it. I'm like, and you don't see the face of a single German soldier in that movie because they're just all Nazis.
Yeah, and also they totally eliminated the colonial troops who were actually on that beach.
Oh,
yeah.
You name it. I mean, but like, but that to me is the thing that pisses me off the most anyway.
Well, but then that gets into specific, like, are the Nazis the Germans? And then this gets into difficult historical questions that, in fact, go back to the time when, during the Nuremberg trial, were the Germans Nazis? Or were the Nazis holding Germans? And what America eventually decided is that it was the Nazis and not the Germans.
It's like saying the troops in Iraq were Republicans.
Right, to some degree, yeah.
Right, because we always do that now. It's like, right. the Nazi soldiers in France, the Nazi soldiers in Poland. No, they were German. They were almost all of them were conscripts, meaning they were slaves.
And that's the difference between historical memory and historical realities.
They were slaves.
In the sense of, because conscription is the violence, the coercion of conscription.
Is it not slavery?
Well, this is what actually the original libertarian thinkers would say, is that it's not slavery because in the last analysis, final analysis, you could always rebel.
Whoa, who says this?
Von Mises.
So Hold on, wait a second.
An omnipotent government.
Are you telling me, Daniel, that Ludwig von Mises, who I've never read, but many of my friends have, said that conscription is not slavery?
No, not conscription. But von Mises argued that all societies are ultimately held up by the will of the people, and that if the people reject a society, they could rebel. He says that, I believe in omnipotent government.
Oh, that's pretty
44.
Smart.
Yeah, and this is...
And this comes back to our big problem here, which is democracy.
Right.
And this is Speyer's whole thing, is democracy. So let's talk about democracy.
Sure.
Okay, so you didn't, first of all, so we established that you didn't come to this project because you were really upset that people with your politics became the worst people on earth.
No, again, they didn't have my politics. Paul Wolfowitz does not and never did have my politics.
I think they kind of did, but we'll get to that later. Well,
that's a historical question. Yeah. I believe the history does not agree with that assumption or claim.
So democracy. All right. So Speyer sees the people, he thinks he sees the people choosing fascism and communism.
Right.
And he says, therefore, these idiots need experts to
manage them.
To manage them, to tell them what the right choices are.
Right.
In the world. Okay. What was the alternative? What would you rather he had done? Like what was the good left thing to do then?
In the 30s.
Yeah.
That's an interesting question. I don't think he needed to be so pessimistic about democracy. I think in this context, education would have been a much more useful strategy and a long-term strategy to take as opposed
like
to
John
managing.
Dewey.
Yeah. Oh, I'm a Deweyan.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, for sure. Right. I'm a Deweyan. Okay. Yeah, I think you have to, I mean, listen, democracy is a gamble. I don't think that's incorrect, but I think the answer isn't to try to subvert that gamble or elide that gamble, but to approach it in a way where you make it a less of a gamble and you actually participate in the demos in an educationist project. Mm-hmm. I think that would have been ideal.
Okay, like in the 30s.
Yeah, and from
and what would you onward, what would you have been educating? What would you have been saying
about the
to the
evil,
map,
about the evils of Nazism, about the horrors of anti-Semitism, about the fact that if the United States or people want to live in a just and peaceful world, it can't be one in which Hitler existed.
But that's exactly what Speyer and his company were saying, and all the progressives, and all the new dealers were saying.
No, but they didn't try to engage a mass constituency in any serious way.
Franklin Roosevelt sure was.
Yeah, for sure. That was a good position. The fireside chats were very good. I'm in favor of that sort of direct democracy.
Oh, so you're not.
This was about Speyer, I thought. The question of what Speyer did.
Well,
yeah.
No, I'm saying you're saying you wish he had done what was in fact done by American progressives.
Participated more actively in those projects. But Speyer is not bad in the 30s is not the problem. Really, the problem is really the post-war era when they, I think, inflate a Soviet threat to mobilize this national security state. The real problem with Speyer, again, was not, this was fascism in Nazi Germany. I think it was a unique threat in world history that the Soviet Union didn't approach, in my opinion. We're learning more, even under Stalin, a genocidal maniac. The Soviet Union didn't approach the threat that Nazi Germany
posed.
What's
your position on Hitler's ambition? What do you think he wanted?
I think he wanted to definitely dominate the continent of Europe and perhaps...
Dominate meaning?
Basically have a Nazi state, a united
direct
Nazi states of
colonization
Europe. Direct colonization
of the entire continent?
Probably not in the Pyrenees, probably eventually go into France. I mean, Operation Sea Lion, if there was any way for them to do that, they would have invaded the UK. I think Hitler... If you had atomic bombs, he would have used them if that was a real possibility. I think there would have been Lebensraum all the way into at least Azerbaijan, particularly have access to the oil fields.
Okay, so this is where I just think I just disagree with you. Historian to historian, I don't see the evidence for that.
In terms of what?
I don't see the evidence. I mean, I don't. So first of all, he enters the war with no long-range bombers, no landing craft, no troop transport craft.
But that's because of the strategy.
He has a navy. He has a navy that's like 10th rated in the world. He can't get out of the North Sea. The U-boats are the only thing in that navy that are worth shit. Let me lay it out.
Okay? Yeah, sure.
This is what I'm giving you right now. And you've heard this, right?
Yeah, of course.
I think I'm giving you possibly the majority position on Hitler and his ambitions, but you can correct me if I'm wrong, but just let me lay it out. Let me lay out the argument. Okay.
Sure.
So we know that these are the facts. Okay. So he enters the war, a shitty navy that can't do anything against the British, can't even get out of the North Sea. That's agreed upon. No landing craft, no troop transports. So there's the prospects of an invasion of a country outside the continent is impossible. It's not happening. But then we also have Hitler himself, and we have the Nazi Party over 20 years prior to that, and we have all them talking constantly about what they want to do, and they hate the Jews, and they also are not talking about killing Jews until 1941, really?
Vansi. Well,
yeah. No. I mean, well, just before Vansi.
I mean, this is...
But that's a different question.
The Hitler-Befelling argument, I think.
Different question.
Okay,
we can get that. We can get to that, too. Yeah. But in terms of his ambitions globally, right? We have him saying over and over again, the United States is the most powerful country or will be the most powerful country on Earth. I want Germany to be powerful. Mostly what I want, this is Hitler talking, in Mein Kampf and in the second book, which is unknown by most people, but it's basically the second Mein Kampf. I just want Germany to be powerful so that we never get invaded again like we were in World War I. We are never dismembered as a country like we were in World War I. We never lose our territory and our people. We never get humiliated in front of the world again. I want a strong military. I want a powerful country. And he also is straight up and super clear. I also fucking want Poland and Western Russia because I believe, he says, that's where the Teutonic people are from. And
Absolutely. Yeah, sure. Colonial periods.
For living space, for the German people, I want that. So he's absolutely an imperialist.
And into the oil in Baku, especially.
No doubt. Yeah. He wants to go all the way to the Ural Mountains. Right. No doubt about it. Now.
You're talking about Western Europe now and France, the relationship
with
France.
I'm talking about the rest of the world. Okay, so.
Oh, the rest of the world. Sure.
I'm talking about, he certainly wants Poland and Western Russia. Everyone in the whole wide world agrees on that. And everybody, there's no question about that. Now, the debate among historians that you and I are now engaging in is, did Hitler ever really want anything other than that permanently?
Well, the question is, does he want to reaffirm Germany's colonial empire, which was stripped in the after World War I? And he says no.
Thank you.
But
he sure does.
Now this is the question. Hitler wins World War II. I think those ambitions change. What, I mean, and this is counterfactual.
Why do you?
Why would you think they didn't? Because this is a megalomaniac, genocidal maniac who killed 6 million Jews.
I'll tell you exactly why, Daniel. Here it is. This is, I love this. Because racists, real racists, honest to God racists, not Donald Trump like semi-racists, but like serious scientific racists like Hitler and like the segregationists in the South were, to a man, anti-imperialist. Why? Because imperialism involves bringing these fucking brown people here and mixing our beautiful, our blonde-haired boys with these nasty, savage natives in these far-off countries.
Yeah, but you could totally imagine colonial relationships that were hyper-exploitative without actually involving mixing of the peoples. I mean, look what happened in South Africa and Rhodesia.
You can imagine it, but he didn't.
No, but in South Africa and Rhodesia, I mean, I don't think it's that difficult for Hitler to look at Rhodesia after winning World War II in 1946 and then being like, oh, that might be a good model to get into the African colonial game. This, to me, is not that much of a leap.
All I know is
by any stretch of the imagination, plus then going, let's say Hitler wins and gets atomic weapons in 1948. You don't think he's then threatening Britain and France with total, basically a colonial relationship. I mean, that's a counterfactual. We'll never know. But to me, this is not a particularly big leap of faith.
I think it's a majority close to a consensus position now.
Amongst whom?
Historians.
No. But who are you referring to?
Oh, I mean,
I think Gerald Weinberg. I mean, like the major World War II people.
Yeah, like Ian Kershaw. I mean, that's his position. Adam Tooze, who you probably like. I mean, his whole argument.
In the Wages of Destruction.
Wages of Destruction. Yeah. His whole argument is that Hitler expanded. In fact, he goes even further than I do.
Right.
He argues that he went into Poland and Western Russia only for economic reasons to get the resources that were there.
Yeah, no, I know that argument. I'm not sure Tooze would necessarily
say. He never wanted to go west, and he certainly, and this is, you cannot say this, right? Hitler had no intentions of attacking the United States directly.
Oh, no, I agree with that. I think there would have been two power blocks.
Okay.
But I think the power block of Hitler at the helm is even different than a power block with Stalin at the helm. Now, Tooze, I think that's a great book. I don't disagree with any of the arguments, but again, Hitler winning World War II is just different.
This is
the overdetermined argument. I don't disagree with that. I think there was very difficult for Germany to have won World War II, given what Hitler did. I agree with that.
German people were literally starving. They did not have enough protein and enough animal fat. By 1939, the average height of German children is already declining because they're not getting enough food.
For sure, but
they made the brilliant idea. They had the brilliant idea of expelling or killing all of their doctors. Good idea, dumb shit.
Scientists.
And guess what happens? Syphilis and gonorrhea go through the roof, and all sorts of infectious diseases are killing Germans right and left.
Sure.
So 90% of your army is slaves. How are you going to take over the world, Daniel Bissner?
Right, that's the overdetermined argument. And I
what,
loathe
what do you mean by that?
That they were lost. This September 1st, 1939, they lost the war.
Yeah.
I'm not sure
okay.
that's the case. I'm not generally not comfortable making those sorts of historical claims. I think, I mean, you know, you're a historian. It's all contingency. Things go a different way. Maybe Heisenberg discovers they don't stop the V2 program's more successful than it is. It happens earlier in the war.
For people who don't know, who was Heisenberg besides the guy in Breaking Bad?
He was, and also in this new movie, he was the one who was basically involved in the atomic energy project. Maybe Rudolf Hess makes a deal with the when he lands in Scotland. I mean, there are so many contingencies involved in this program, and I just don't think that a United States of Nazi Europe was an impossibility or outside Hitler's imagination. I don't think that anything points to that, honestly.
Okay. It's all counterfactuals on both sides, but well, not on my side. Well, anyway.
Well, yeah, but the argument's the overdetermined aspect of it—that it was that he lost the war on September 1st, 1939.
I don't know why you say overdetermined. I just don't.
That there was no capacity for the Nazis to win that war, to win a two-front war.
Oh, it was possible, sure, but highly, highly unlikely. And mostly, for me, it was the lack of interest among the German people that really sealed the deal for him.
How do you define that?
If there had been any kind of serious popular support, maybe he could have done some damage elsewhere. But also, Hitler didn't want it. He didn't want it. The guy, the whole thing about blood and soil is about this place here is what we care about. They don't give a fuck about North America and Africa and all these other places. He and the Nazis, that's their whole thing, right?
But again,
they love this soil and this place and these people.
That I think elides the history of German colonialism, which had a deep history in German political culture. And it wasn't that long after when Hitler comes to power in the 30s. And again, when he won World War I in the 40s, that's only 25 years after Germany lost its colonies. So he would have definitely had to ally with monarchists. He would have definitely had to ally with the Prussian landed aristocracy. He would have definitely had to ally with the overseas business interests. And again, counterfactual, but it doesn't seem that there could have been a united front in Germany.
He has his own generals trying to kill him. I mean,
are you talking about Stauffenberg? But then he could quickly consolidated power immediately after.
Before
Keitel and Jodl.
This
is really in the weeds.
I know. Even before then, from the very get go, and you know this, his generals are coming to him and saying, "Guy, look, dude, we can't do this. We cannot do this. We don't have enough bullets. We don't have enough. We don't have any copper in this country. We have to go elsewhere to get the copper." And Hitler's like, "Fuck it, we gotta go because we're gonna die if we don't." Because the United States is building up as fast as it can and they're going to kill us. And he was right, unless we do this now. Anyway.
Yeah, no, for sure.
Read my book, you'll find out. I know you know this. It's just I'm trying to introduce the audience to a very interesting argument that I've been enmeshed in for
years. It's important stuff.
It's also crucial for your book and your argument here. Okay. Speyer says, okay, the people are stupid or they're evil or some combination of the two. By the way, did he ever sort of characterize the people in any way? They just made mistakes.
Ignorant, feckless.
Ignorant, yeah, right. Well,
unlikely to be educated in the way and time necessary.
Okay. Now, wasn't he right? Isn't he still right?
I think it's a problem that—
Why on earth do you want Americans to control American or any foreign policy?
Again, this goes back to the question of democracy is a gamble, but it's the best of all possible systems. Because otherwise, then you have, again, vanguardist. Basically, we all know nothing. And I'd rather live in a society where the demos or a collective or a democratic collective is able to make decisions as opposed to the experts of the world being totally unaccountable to anyone but themselves, or to business interests being totally unaccountable to anyone but their profit, but profit and their shareholders. So I believe that there's always, you know, we're again all fallen, but democracy is a system that it could at least be accountable. The most people have an investment in the political system, you know, and the state is just another corporation to some degree in it, but at least it's a corporation that's accountable to the people, which is better than a corporation, than being governed by corporations accountable only to shareholders.
How many Americans have you known?
Many.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. I think you're right in the sense that obviously not everyone is at the place that I would want them to be. I think this is the educationist project. And it's an ongoing project. It's never ending.
I will not characterize Americans in any way except this. And it's just true. And Americans would agree with me because they have to. They don't know a goddamn thing about what we're talking about.
But
they don't have no clue what we're talking about.
Are the experts better?
They don't know where Syria is. They didn't even know Syria existed until a couple of years ago. And still, probably most of them don't, right?
But did George W. Bush, when he invaded Iraq?
I don't want anyone to be accountable to those people who are running foreign policy.
So then who should be the... How should society be governed?
I don't want it to be.
So you're an anarchist.
Well, I certainly don't want...
So spontaneous organization.
I certainly don't want anyone... I don't want anyone with control over that arsenal.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's sure.
Well, that's it.
Yeah, then we have to work towards disarmament, global disarmament.
Get rid of the arsenal, number one.
Unilaterally.
Sure. Get rid of the arsenal, number one. Number two, get rid of the executive power over that arsenal, which I'm sure you agree with. And Speier was all about executive power.
I agree with
aggrandizing executive power, giving the president as much power over these death machines as possible, right?
I totally agree.
Reduce that radically. You wrote an op-ed in the New York Times recently.
And they don't actually, but they don't actually have the power that in the way that you're presenting. Command and control structures are actually much looser than the president pushes a button in nuclear
war. Oh, you're talking about nuclear war.
Yeah. But we keep, that goes down a rabbit hole.
Yeah.
I mean, read Daniel Ellsberg's recent book.
You certainly
really
agree.
Good on that.
You certainly agree that the executive has a whole bunch of unilateral power.
Yeah.
Okay. In foreign policy.
Get rid of all of that.
Of course.
Okay. Yeah. Don't get me wrong.
We agree on that. No, of course. You wrote an op-ed in the New York Times recently.
I did.
You sure did.
I did.
And I actually forgot about it until this minute. It just came out like last week, right?
Yeah, a week ago today.
Yeah. Okay, so you lay out, and this is it, right? You say, this is what a left-wing foreign policy should look like, or at least you sketch it out, right?
Yeah, the principles, not particular policies.
And I wouldn't say I would vote for any of it, but I think it's all moving in the right direction from my perspective. You know, I think it's way less radical than I would like, but you know,
these are time horizons, and
for sure, always in a good direction. Everything you propose is in a good direction. So it's a 4-point right program. Let's do it. Five?
5 points.
Do it. Lay it out.
So the first one is democracy, which is just basically making the executive.
You don't like that. I already covered that. Sorry.
No worries.
Go ahead.
Essentially limiting the power of the executive in foreign policy and bringing Congress more into the process. Accountability, so that people like Paul Wolfowitz don't move from.
Okay, so let's just stay there for a second. So sure. What does that mean specifically? Like, you want to reduce the power of the executive.
To make war.
Totally agree.
Yeah.
What else?
Reduce the power of executives to make war. I didn't talk about the details in the op-ed, but basically get rid of FISA courts, these unaccountable courts that are basically rubber stamps for American presidents to kill who they want abroad. Mm-hmm. Draw down executive surveillance of the domestic population. Make it much more difficult to deploy troops overseas. Make public all information about what Americans are doing abroad. We were deployed in 149.
I love that one.
Yeah, special forces were deployed in 149 places, countries in 2017. This relates to my point about anti-militarism, but we have roughly 800 bases.
And by the way, and even members of Congress don't know about that.
Yeah, right? I mean, this is all, right. Basically stop the overclassification of all national security information. Mm-hmm. I don't think I think much more of it could be public than is. And basically bringing Congress back into the process. Now, people will say it's not exactly if Congress was in control of things would be less, maybe less aggressive or less militarist. But again, this is part of a larger project with education, making people aware of what the American Empire does. To me, it's insane that American children don't know that they exist in a global empire. This is not even a part of our textbooks. Mm-hmm. Things like that, making this larger project of a project of education, letting people know democracy, mm-hmm. bringing people into the process. Mm-hmm. Step two is accountability. So make it one sense professionally accountable so that Jeb Bush doesn't go from the Bush Defense Department to being on Jeb Bush's foreign policy team X amount of years later.
Wait, sorry, Wolfowitz.
Wolfowitz doesn't go on being George W.'s team to Jeb Bush's team. Mm-hmm. I didn't put this in the op-ed. It's only so many words, but that, you know, the media shouldn't hire these people as talking heads either, and that it has to be a larger project that people who contribute to disastrous decisions like Iraq, and Afghanistan and Libya aren't basically members of elite media, polite society.
Good boy. How do we enforce that though?
It's you can't enforce.
It's just a cultural thing.
It's a cultural thing. Okay. Culture is important. I mean, like just these are.
We should be complaining loudly.
Complaining loudly, and
people will listen. Yeah.
You know, Rachel Maddow or whomever shouldn't have them on her show.
Gotcha.
You know, things Chris Hayes shouldn't have. These are not serious people, and they're disastrous and to some degree.
I once yelled at Chris Hayes on Twitter, and I wrote an article about it too, about how he had when Obama was trying to bomb Syria. How he had, over the course of a week, like just this, like 10 or 15 right. pro-interventionists. And he was like, what do you mean? the other half of my guests were opposed to intervention.
Right. Like, come on. These aren't equal positions. I mean, I don't think that this both sidesism doesn't work in this case. I think it's very clear that these policies have failed and they shouldn't be members of these polite elite societies any longer. And to me, that's not radical. That's just prudence. Mm-hmm. Step three was anti-militarism. Really, that for me, that's mostly drawing down the base empire, the 800 to 1,000 bases, depending on who you ask.
You're talking about closing bases?
I'm talking about closing bases.
How many?
As many as humanly possible. I would say probably most of them. I think that America shouldn't have access to these international death machines that encourages it to do what it wants in the world.
You mean
in terms of violence?
Nukes?
I'm talking about basically these bases that provide forward staging areas for long-range bombers, ICBM placements, whatever it may be. I would say also get rid of a lot of the aircraft carriers, which would open up an enormous amount for other forms of, I think, more positive spending, particularly on the domestic economy in this era of rising income inequality. Number four is threat deflation. Since the beginning of the Republic, as you know, Americans have inflated threats. I think we are insanely safe. I think it's a peculiar feature of modernity that people want to put risk to zero. Things like terrorism are facts of an interconnected world. They're not signs of American weakness or American unsafety. That's an educationist cultural project. You have to make people realize just how safe we are. And that, again, I think Nazi Germany could have challenged our sovereignty, but I don't think that's ever been true elsewhere in American history. Mm-hmm. People need to be aware of that. And then foreign internationalism, which I framed as mostly pressuring our allies like Saudi Arabia and Israel, say we're not going to give you arms transfers if you keep on doing these horrible human rights violations on one hand, closing down tax havens by working with other countries on the other hand to sort of and help end this domestic inequality.
I do kind of like tax havens. I'm gonna. That's the only place where I don't like.
Well, but we could go into that. I literally see no social good being produced by them. But basically that sort of project. And this is a project not for the policymakers because I don't think people in the American state should be, for example, funding political parties abroad. But I think if we're thinking about things like I said before in a larger socialist movement, civil organizations and organizations like that should build connections with comrades abroad and see what they want and try to help them achieve their goals in whatever way possible on a sub-state level and the level of civil society.
There it is.
So that we begin building these sorts of larger organizations so we could hopefully transcend nationalism, which I don't think is a particularly good thing, and start recognizing our common humanity. Now, again, this is not going to happen in 1, 5, or 10 years, but maybe in 200. And this we have to start now.
Yeah.
There you go. Boom.
Okay. Good. I'll give it an A-.
A+.
But the question I have is, why didn't Bernie Sanders say any of this?
For a variety of reasons. I think Americans don't vote on foreign policy.
Why doesn't Rachel Maddow say any of this?
Because Rachel Maddow doesn't believe it. I think Rachel Maddow is an interventionist.
Yeah.
Isn't she?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yes.
Well, I mean, I don't know what she is, but she's certainly, I mean, she wrote this whole book about how terrible American wars have been, and she pretends, have you ever read that book?
No, I've never read it.
Democrats make no appearance in it.
Yeah, so
isn't that amazing?
Yeah, I mean, that's political hackery.
I'm like, what are you talking about? She does like a quick survey of the last 100 years of American bloodshed, and it's all Ronald Reagan's fault.
Yeah.
I'm like, wait a minute.
No, I mean, it's wrong. It's not historically true.
It's this incredible.
I mean, the Democrats and Republicans
Bernie,
are equally.
Come on. You must have been a Bernie guy.
Oh, yeah, of course. Do you want me to say why I think he did
it?
Several reasons. One, I think most important, Americans in 2016 weren't voting on foreign policy.
But why?
Because Americans generally, again, this educationist project, they're not aware of the way that their country actually informs the world, or they don't care. And if they don't care, we have to make that different. Believe me, it's a problem.
It's the cross you and I, the cross every foreign policy person bears, right? The Americans don't know a goddamn thing about this.
Sure. And as I said in the op-ed, the left has been denied of foreign policy thinking. I think there's been a lot of problems. Like I would critique the Chomsky generation of totally giving up on any pretensions to governance. I don't think that was a great move because when you're not at the table, I think other people are at the table. So it's not a particularly American left-wing thing. The left-wing has also never governed in the United States. So it's never had to deal with foreign policy.
When you say
policy.
Left, you're talking about socialist left.
Socialist left. Yeah. I don't consider liberalism today, as you know, is not a particularly left-wing thing. So there's a lot of reasons why he didn't. I think he's getting a lot better on it. He published that piece in The Guardian. My understanding is he's going to be giving a speech soon on it.
Oh yeah.
So he will hopefully, and I think he will, take some of these things more seriously. And I have no doubt he will. And I think it's important to building the sort of politics that socialists want, democratic socialists want, having a real
Okay, so then, all right. So then why haven't, I mean, I know some serious socialists have been very aware and very loud about foreign policy for a long time, right? But very few. So why the left generally in this country, you know, smart, intellectual, people with PhDs, why do they never care, seem to care or talk about foreign policy?
It's a really important question. And I just point people to Aziz Rana has written several essays on this in M plus one. And I think one of the main conclusions is that the left has historically been focused on bread and butter issues.
Spell the last name.
R-A-N-A.
Okay.
The first name Aziz. Mm-hmm. And I think that's for a variety of reasons. Many leftist leaders came out of the labor movement, which is particularly domestic focused for a variety of reasons, focused on workplace issues. And I think probably the most important reason, again, the left has never governed. So foreign policy is, as you know, is a project very centralized in the American executive. And so if you've never been president, oftentimes you never actually had to deal with the problems of governing the American empire.
Right.
So this is what I'm trying to do. What I'm worried about is that it's 2020 or 2024, a socialist wins, and who the hell do they staff their NSC with? Right. And so these are the problems that we have to be thinking so that we begin drawing down this empire. And the reason my piece wasn't radical is because I don't think it was intended to, it's not a radical piece because it's actually trying to get, what do you do on day one, 2020, and there's this 1,000 bases and a military that's 100%
sure.
against you?
Oh, yeah. Oh, no, I'm really glad you published that piece in the Times. I mean, for the New York Times, it is radical.
Yeah, well, it's changing.
And again, so you kind of, you were pushing the Overton window there in a good way, yeah. I thought. So that I'm all for it. I just, you know, I'm not going to, I'm just the kind of crazy weirdo who won't like formally endorse anything that isn't exactly what I think.
No, that's good. It's good to have principles.
Yeah. Well, Daniel Bessner, thank you very much for talking to me, and thank you for dealing with my criticism, and thank you for being a professor who's willing to talk to me in public.
Oh,
I hope you
it.
Don't get in too much trouble for this.
I also hope that, but thanks so much. It was really great.
Good. Thanks, man. This was the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. To support the show and become a member of the Unregistered community, go to unregisteredunderground.com. To get information and to buy tickets to the Renegade University weekend events in Los Angeles and Washington, D.C., go to ThaddeusRussell.com/courses. Thanks for listening.